to Star Wars? Well, of course you do, because you're listening to the Rancor Pit. And if you like the Star Wars, like those of us who are old enough to at least claim this, you've liked it since 1977.
That's right.
And myself and, of course, Eddie Medina, who just chimed in, have known the Star Wars since 1977 and beyond.
Yes, and one other person has known Star Wars from 1977 and beyond. That's our special guest, Vic Medina. Vic, say hi.
Most impressive.
that's nice. Not a bad Vader.
That is not. And
we should get
this coming from one of the creators of Revenge of the
That's right.
Revenge of the Sixth.
Fifth. No, Revenge of the Fifth.
Fifth, that's right.
.net.
I'm just adding days to the calendar there.
Right. That's not bad, Vader. We should get Vic to do like a voiceover for the opening music or something.
Oh, that's so true.
He could like record something and I can tweak it and make it like a Darth Vader.
Yeah, we need to do
voice.
A thing like we have on Hey Kids Comics anyway. So.
Yeah. We may be hitting you up for that, Vic. So practice your Vader a little bit.
We may have to send you some copy.
Well, yeah, Vic.
Welcome,
has it.
Vic.
It's been a while since we've had Vic, and if, for those who may be new since he was last on, the last name is not a coincidence. He's actually my older brother, and the one who not only is responsible for introducing me to Star Wars, but also introduced me to G.I. Joe, the A-Team, Battlestar Galactica, anything I've found out about Mego Pocket Heroes. That came by way of Vic saying, hey, check out this stuff. Because I probably wouldn't have discovered it on my own had it not been for Vic kind of like pointing me in the right direction.
And I apologize for that.
Yeah, you had to answer Colleen now because she has to deal with all the big collection I've amassed since then.
Right. Just don't keep a running tab of how much you've spent. That's what I tried not to do.
Every now and again I'll look around my entire collection and think, and people will ask sometimes, how much did you spend on all this? Like, I don't know. It's been 40 years of spending.
It was either this or like a mansion in the Caribbean. I went with the collection, you know.
There you go. Well, as I often say, I don't smoke and I don't drink worth a damn, so I'm spending all my smoke and drinking money this way.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, like we, in the opening, I'm talking about like 1977, Star Wars arrives on the scene and changes everything. It becomes this phenomenon beyond anything anyone would have imagined.
Right.
But for our 76th episode, it occurred to me what might be interesting is to let's look at what life was like in 1976, hence the spirit of 76, and, you know, the 70s in general, but specifically, what was going on? What were we watching? What were we seeing, collecting, playing with? What was our life like before there was Star Wars in it? And it, just in the scant amount of research, it's been rather remarkable to discover what all was going on in the 70s. But let's lead in with the Medinas here. And, you know, in the mid-70s, what were the sort of things you were, you know, television, movies, what were your entertainments before Star Wars showed up?
Well, Vic, since you're the guest, why don't you kick it off and you can do this part.
Well, I was born in 71, so I was barely, I mean, I wasn't even 6 years old when Star Wars opened. So I have very...
You're just a bunch of kids is the problem.
Oh, yeah. But I do remember, I mean, there was a, you know, a time there where, and I do recommend for people who haven't seen it, I'm assuming if you're a Star Wars fan, that you watched the documentary on Netflix, The Toys That Made Us.
Oh, yes.
Because, and not just the Star Wars episode, because if you watch the Barbie episode, the Lego episode, there's some just incredible insight into the thinking of the time and what's that. It's how it hasn't changed. I remember the Barbie episode. You know, I'm not a Barbie collector by any means, but I was fascinated with it because you had they talked about the upward struggle to get toys for little girls.
Yes, and, absolutely.
And dolls back then were baby dolls. And so there was a lot of talk about how to make all that work. And it made me, it reminded me how that's kind of the same problem today. I mean, you've got, everyone talks about, you know, the Jen Ursos and the Rays and the Rose figures don't sell, or this, that, or the other. And I remember in particular, even though it's not Star Wars related, I believe it was when Captain America Civil War came out, they didn't put they didn't put in a Black Widow action figure with her motorcycle.
Yeah, and there was a Captain America instead, because, oh, that's right.
Because they thought that it wouldn't sell. So I'm thinking, is that what we've come to? And it's, you know, it's just amazing that all it takes is for these little companies, like Kenner or something like that, to change the industry. And I mean, they really and sincerely kicked off the mass merchandising craze.
Oh, absolutely. But let's speak to toys for a moment. When you were growing up, when you were, you know, just a wee one, what were the kind of toys that you had or were aware of? Because I remember a lot of very distinctive toys of the 70s
that bordered on
what Star Wars would become.
Right. Well, every once in a while, we picked up Amigo figure.
Yeah.
And I know we picked up one here and there, which, you know, at my age, that kind of fit, because there was, you know, Wizard of Oz was so popular at that time, and there was, you know, the superheroes did really well. And I know we had Batman and Superman, and we just kind of wore them out.
I was going to ask you which ones we had, because being a couple of years younger, I was thinking we had Batman. I couldn't remember if we had Robin or Superman. I know we didn't have Spider-Man, because that would have been the one I wanted but didn't get.
Right.
I mean, no,
Robin eventually.
Okay, we did.
But I know we got Superman, Batman, because I remember at that young age having that whole problem with the chess logo. So you do.
Right. The logo came off, so he was just like bootleg Batman at that point.
Oh, he was just like, man.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there was still an action figure market, and I think, you know, you were transitioning from G.I. Joe, which was kind of dying. In fact, it's funny. I actually looked it up, and I'm really surprised the toy line did as well as it did, because in the mid-70s, I mean, we were coming off of Vietnam was literally, what, like 3 or 4 years prior far as the official end of the Vietnam War. And that, I know, affected a lot of people. It almost affected us, because our father almost went to Vietnam. He didn't have to go, because he had already served in the Army. He had put in his time, and he lived on a farm. So they gave a deferment. I think that's the word they gave for it, even though.
Yeah, that is correct.
He actually went down to the recruiting office, and he was going to go. Now, my two sisters had been born, and I was born in 71. So you'd have somebody else hosting or co-guesting right now if he had. But I remember my dad telling me that the recruiting officer told him, you know, that this war is going to be over in a couple of years. You don't have to go. You've done your time. Go home to your family. And he talked him out of it.
Wow. I forgot that story. Oh, my gosh. That's an eye-opening story. It almost brings a tear to my eye, because I'd forgotten that story from years back when Dad told it. You know, of course, our dad is has long passed on. But good night. That's crazy.
Still, that's quite the story.
Right.
Well, you mentioned, Vic, that you were born in 71. A toy that was very popular in, had hit in about 71, was the Weebles. And I think that they remained in production well into the late 70s and early 80s.
We also had the Fisher-Price
PlayStation. Oh, the little people.
You're asking what toys we played with back then prior to Star Wars. Fisher-Price. That was it. Yeah. That's all I remember is like the little Fisher-Price people.
Because we had the McDonald's playset. We had the Sydney
You know, funny thing, the McDonald's playset was by a different company, and all the figures would be very popular with, designer vinyl types today, because they were, if you look it up, they were all very squarish and blocky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where the little people had more of a rounded body. I guess to distinguish themselves, the company that made the McDonald's playset, because my little brother had it as well, was that they made them just incredibly squared off. I mean, just geometrically the most cubist little guys you could imagine. But I remember distinctly, like, the cash register had a bell behind it.
That's right.
So the
yeah.
face of the cash register, you would smack it and ding, ding, ding. You know.
Right. But I'll tell you, the Fisher-Price set, I really want it, and it really plays into why I'm currently still obsessed with play sets. And I'll touch on it a little quickly a little later, because I'll get off on a tangent. But one of the things that I really loved and wish I still had was the Sesame Street.
Yes.
Place. Oh, wow. I almost had that one. That was cool.
We were in a down in Waxahachie, one of the antique shops, just like about 3 or 4 years ago, and they had the Sesame Street thing in extremely good condition. I almost bought it. Colleen was actually trying to talk me into getting it. It was $50.
That is not bad.
It was a great price, but I thought, oh my gosh, like, what am I going to do with this though for $50? And I passed on it, and I kind of regretted it after that, because that was my favorites were always the Sesame Street set and the airport set that we had.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what's funny? I mean, we were almost kind of forced to play with those kind of toys, because it was either that or it was like what they call the dime store toys that were sold at point of sale, you know, displays that were, you know, inexpensive or whatever. And, you know, you would grab some of those. But I actually looked up, and I didn't realize this, that right after, in the middle of the Vietnam War in the mid-70s, California actually passed a law prohibiting toys of bombs, grenades, and anything that was related to war.
What?
Oh, yeah. Wow.
You could do guns, apparently. Guns were still done, but it, like...
No way.
But I remember having, like, toy grenades as a kid and all that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
They outlawed it, and which is why, I guess, you see from the 70s, I mean, I think anyone who's seen Jingle All the Way remembers the Sinbad talking about the Johnny Five guns in one. That's from the 60s. And then
absolutely.
And then you didn't see many guns until, you know, until G.I. Joe, well, and Star Wars did laser guns. So,
It just sort of made guns acceptable again, kind of eased people back into it. Mm-hmm. Because speaking to G.I. Joe, facing faltering sales of America's movable fighting man, G.I. Joe morphed from a martial sort of entity into what became known as the Adventure Team.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
So the G.I. Joe guys were out, you know, fighting
crocodiles and Sasquatch.
And sharks. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
They were fighting nature at that point.
Yeah, half the playsets were nature-based.
It was like the figure version of Day of the Animals.
They ended up doing that later with the 3 3/4 inch line when you had the Eco Warriors in the.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, they did bring it back to that.
Another
you might remember from the period, apparently beginning in 1973, I remember being so jealous of anyone who owned any of this, was the Evel Knievel stunt cycle. And
see,
all of the
various.
I don't
know if we bought that, although we were obsessed. No. Evel Knievel.
Everybody was.
Yeah. I remember our the kid next door, Junior, had the Evel Knievel set. So, Vic, if you remember playing with it, it was because he had it.
That's got to be it. Yeah, I couldn't remember who had it, but yeah.
Well, here's one in my research. I was very surprised dated back to 76 and lasted until about 1980. Stretch Armstrong.
When did that start?
It was first released in 1976.
I didn't know it was that old of a
yeah.
Toy.
I mean,
I thought that came out.
I thought it was older. I'm surprised.
Yeah, I'm with Eddie. I could have sworn it was a much younger product than 76.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
That was
but
pretty remarkable.
Now
to
that
find.
You mention it, now that you mention it, there is like superhero versions that came out in the 60s and 70s of Hulk. And
yeah, so it's about 78, somewhere between 76 and 78, you start seeing the Batman and Superman ones as well.
I remember I saw Hulk either at an antique store or at a Comic-Con, and the person hadn't hadn't, because apparently you have to treat the old Stretch Armstrongs with a type of oil to keep them from cracking. And this Hulk, this Hulk looked like the Thing. There were so many cracks in it.
Yeah, and good night. And the corn syrup does set up over years. It solidifies.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an organic product. So. But also interesting, the premiere of the Micronauts.
Yeah.
They hit the stores in 76. So
we never got into the Micronauts. Did you, Cole?
A little bit. My younger brother had some Micronauts, probably by 77, 78. You know, by the time I was getting, he was 4 years younger, and so I was really getting into Star Wars, and he was getting into Micronauts, among other things.
Yeah.
And this is one I thought was really fun that sets the stage before we move on to other things. Where were we in this period in the 70s? 1975.
Mm-hmm.
This little unassuming novelty came out of nowhere and became like a multi-million dollar industry for about a couple of years. The Pet Rock.
Oh my gosh.
That was 75? Wow.
Yeah.
But that kind of fits for the time. I mean, because you had such a weird, dark sort of kind of period where people were like, we don't need Toy Hero Rock kind of a thing. I mean, that really thing, I think, appealed to parents who thought it was funny. That's the only way I could, because I don't remember.
It was the thing that you bought for someone else more often than not. You would, like, go and buy your Pet Rock. You'd see it at the Hallmark store or something like that, the gift store. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think more people were given Pet Rocks than purchased Pet Rocks for themselves. Mm-hmm. And the other one that harkens back to about the same period, first created in 1975, and I know I wanted one, the Mood Ring.
I was going to say, Mood Rings went right along with the Pet Rocks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. This was a period where novelty, I think, that's where we were culturally, is just anything that was a distraction or a novelty was a thing. And if you're unfamiliar, the Mood Ring was just sort of a, anywhere from a generic looking to a slightly decorative ring that had an oval shaped kind of glass or crystalline looking centerpiece, fairly sizable. And it had kind of effectively what they were using was dyes and a kind of liquid crystal thermometer type technology. And the idea was that it would pick up on your mood. And I guess they worked out which colors were most prevalent if you were pissed off or you were happy.
Yeah.
And it actually did, to a certain degree, kind of adjust and adapt to your skin temperature. Mm-hmm. But, it just sort of speaks to how stupid a lot of stuff was, consumer goods.
You know,
it's been expensive. I mean, I've even looked up with the new Mego dolls coming out again. Mego action figures. I'm in some of those groups just because for the nostalgia.
Mego was huge.
Yeah, I mean, and I looked at a bunch of ads from the time, and I didn't remember you could pick up a Mego doll for like $2. And I did not remember that. So, and I think that's what I think toys really changed with Star Wars, because you had that, and then when you followed with, you know, Masters of the Universe, some of these others, where you had these huge toys in higher price points, where suddenly, and of course it was the 80s too, so there was more disposable income where people could afford to pay up.
Reaganomics. Yeah,
I'll tell you, the other day I was I'm trying to reclaim my garage, and I found the packaging for the Kenner large size, the 12-inch Stormtrooper.
Oh wow! That was just in your garage?
Yeah, this is my garage for you. Most of that was crated up, and there was another large size box I was able to slot it in a crate.
Uh-huh.
But this one had a sticker still on it. And the exorbitant price in 1978 for one of these things was an outrageous budget-busting $9.99.
Which was pretty expensive for back then.
Well, that was 5 3¾-inch figures, I'll point out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you had to
tell you. Eddie can tell you what our budget was usually when we went to the toy store and we had sort of a Star Wars budget.
Nice.
Do you remember this?
I don't remember the exact amount, but I remember we'd do all of our chores and like every other weekend we'd go pick out a figure, it seemed
one.
Like, but I could be wrong. One. Yeah, yeah, between us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So
it was either that, and if we didn't do that, then it was to the spinner rack at 7-Eleven to get some comics. But it was always like roundabouts $2.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. So picking up the land speeder, I remember we picked up the land speeder at the Kmart, and we dropped a 5-spot on that, and I was like, woo! And so that's why. And I think as we got older, we got some of the playsets, which I think were in the $10 to $12 range. But we never got the Falcon. We never got the Death Star. Well, I've got them now, but I mean, at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, now, when it matters the least because you're not playing with them.
Right.
But no, we were shrewd in that Vic and I would get a lot of our, whether it was G.I. Joe or Star Wars, the vehicles and the play sets, we would snag them at like garage sales and thrift town.
There you go.
So
that was a time when you were still early on, you would occasionally find these toys at garage sales and such. Pretty routinely.
It was pretty routine, even when there was still a Star Wars craze, because you don't know the backstory, but it could have been that little Johnny ticked off mom and dad that week, and so
that's
they decided
right.
to
there
throw all
Star
the
Star
Wars
toys.
Yeah, exactly, that weekend, and we just, you know, his bad luck, our good luck type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Just real quick, in talking about what toys that we play with prior to Star Wars, before we move on, one toy that I need to point out that I'm still actually collecting to this day that I was collecting prior to Star Wars were Hot Wheels.
Oh,
I mean,
yes, of course.
That,
they've been
that
around
was,
forever.
Right. And
back then, Matchbox cars were fairly common.
Yes, Matchbox and Hot Wheels. So that was a big thing. Prior to the action figure craze in our world, like our universe consisted of the little Fisher-Price Little People and Hot Wheels.
And, of course, ubiquitous throughout all of these periods were things like the Green Army Men or Cowboys and Indians, or, you know, I remember the Marx Toys was heavily in the 70s producing big play sets like Fort Apache.
Yes, that's right.
You know,
they had the little fences and everything.
Yeah, and they would have like the fort was lithoed tin. So it was like a big stockade walls, you know, timbers. And me personally, I always say that both literally and figuratively, dinosaurs came before Star Wars. And I was huge into Mark's Dinosaurs and had all these great play sets and stuff back in those days. And all the different colored, you know, solid mold dinosaurs.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, and then, of course, Dangerous Toys. That you could never sell today, like a toy Mattel had. I'm trying to remember, it was like Creature Maker or something, and it had this actual heating element, and you would put these little plastic squares on it, and the heat would cause them to unfurl into the actual shape they were originally molded in.
Mm-hmm.
They were factory pressed into little squares from their original shape.
That's weird. I don't think I ever heard of those.
Well, Shrinky Dinks was the same sort of concept.
They'd be oven fresh, and you'd be like anxious to grab this little hard
Which
plastic, you'd be like Tote in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
they should make a Raiders set nowadays.
Yes, right.
Where and make the Tote just kind of melt, you know, more than the rest. But another mainstay in toy boxes in our household prior to Star Wars were Viewmasters.
Of course, brilliant. Yes, the Viewmaster was very.
It was like, to put in an odd sort of connection to nowadays what kids are obsessed with, it was like our generation's smartphone, where you had a device, the Viewmaster, and every so often you got to get another package of reels, which was a big deal, like whether it was the Robin Hood reel or the Gulliver's Travels or whatever the heck they made prior to Star Wars.
The Age of Dinosaurs, the White Oval
House. We had the dinosaur one. That's right.
They'd have, like, different superhero adventures. And it was wild as they would do, like, these comic book images, but they would be, like, they'd cut out the different images and put them in a little diorama or something.
Yeah, like a little layer.
Depth.
Uh-huh.
And another one I remembered, I just occurred to me, and what's interesting is this became a Star Wars licensed product later on. But in the, you know, mid to... heading into the 70s, you know, from about the, say, 73, 74 on forward, the Presto Magics, which had, like, a little, you know, scene, almost like the background of a cartoon, and you would have these different characters on sheets, and you would rub on them with a pencil, and they would transfer onto the background. Mm-hmm. And there were even Star Wars Presto Magics. Oddly enough, it wasn't until, like, Jedi that you started to see a lot of Star Wars Presto Magics.
Yeah, I do remember.
They had to wait till they had the money to buy the license or something.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, but, let's talk a bit about television. I mean, you guys were just little kids, but there were a lot of interesting things when I started looking at television in the set in 76 specifically. One of the things that really caught my eye was The Muppet Show premiered in 1976.
Did it really?
Yes, it went from 1976
to 1981. I thought that came later. That's wild.
It's kind of remarkable. I thought it was much later, too. So I start with The Muppet Show because that has a Star Wars pedigree.
Of course,
and then by 1980, you have the Star Wars kind of crossing over into The Muppet Show. But I don't know what kind of shows at your age you might have been watching or aware of.
Oh, definitely the Brady Bunch. I mean, that was the go-to, I think, in our house was
but
Brady
I think
Bunch.
At that point, we were watching reruns. I think they went into
reruns. Yeah, you would have been watching.
Oh, my bad. Okay, I thought you were just
hard
asking
to
personally.
Distinguish, though. You bring up a good point. Is a lot of times it's hard to distinguish where were you falling in reruns versus, you know, actually airing.
That's true.
But the Carol Burnett Show, which began in 1967, was still a couple of years before it was canceled.
Yeah, and we watched that a lot because they would show it in the afternoons as well.
That's right. They did in the Dallas market.
Yeah, in some areas they did. And I'll tell you that it was funny. I was showing Chris a couple of clips from – because they did a special on Carol Burnett, some sort of retrospective on PBS. And it got me thinking. I said, you have got to see some of the things they did back then. And I said, there's one that you have to see that they could never do today. And it sounds terrible, but if you watch it, it is one of the funniest things I've ever seen, where Lyle Waggoner played a World War II POW. And,
I remember
it wasn't Harvey Korman, but Tim Conway. I'm sorry. Tim Conway was a Nazi interrogator.
Yes, I remember this.
I have some memory of that, too, now that you mention it.
Is that the one with the puppet?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
He's going to bring out the big guns, and he brings out a Hitler puppet. Who then starts saying, I've been working on the railroad. Just to crawl Waggoner up, and it is one of the puppets.
That is. I remember that. Now that you mentioned the puppets.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, I've got one you might remember. Welcome Back, Cotter.
Love
premiered in 1975.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I remember wanting to go see Saturday Night Fever. And my sister, who was already 18 at the time, was like, you are not going to go see Saturday. So we were nagging. But you know what? Another one that was a milestone for me was the premiere of Wonder Woman, 1975.
That's right. And Wonder Woman.
Right.
And I'm glad you brought up Wonder Woman because I wanted to speak a bit. Where was science fiction, in this case on television, in 76? And you had not only the already running $6 million man, but the premiere of the Bionic Woman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, speaking to 76, as we're saying this, I came across an old ad from 1976. An ad, either it looks like it's either out of a comic book or a newspaper for CBS Saturday Morning. This is your lineup
in
1976.
I like it.
1976, you had this is Eastern time, 8:30 a.m., you had the Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner hour. 9:30, you had Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? 10 o'clock, you had 10 o'clock, and then 10:30, you had the Shazam Isis hour.
Oh, almighty Isis.
That was
still an Egyptian.
That was
goddess.
Your CBS Saturday. Yeah. So that was your CBS Saturday: Bugs Bunny, Scooby Doo, Shazam, and ISIS. And in between, you would have In the News with Christopher Glenn.
I remember In the News. Where. Good Lord.
Uh huh. Yeah. So I guess those were those little news things that would pop up between shows.
Yeah, I was like, this is In the News, and it was like boring.
Yes, that's a good takeoff of those with Kermit the Frog. And if you remember, Sesame Street would come out and do these live news reports, and they would have the same sort of intro. And he would say he would do some kind of ridiculous story that would all fall apart because he was doing a live shot.
Oh,
and he would always start off with "Hi ho, Kermit the Frog here."
Hi ho, Kermit the Frog here.
So I mean, there was already some, and I don't remember. I never watched Space 1999. I think that was before. That had already run its course by this point. I'm not really sure, and I know Star Trek had. But
yeah, definitely.
But the animated series, I think, had come out around that time.
Among other things, Saturday morning, ABC was bringing you some stuff. I don't even remember.
I'm looking at the ABC lineup.
The Reluctant Dragon and Mr. Toad.
I remember the Reluctant Dragon.
I vaguely remember Motor Mouse. I definitely remember Lancelot Link. Secret Ship.
That's one of Vic's favorites.
The Evolution Revolution is banned.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, with that Ed Sullivan monkey that would introduce
Oh, that's
him.
Right, with a really big shoo. Woo, woo, woo.
Yeah, with spin around.
It is like right in embedded in my brain forever.
I was going to say just one other little thing that also reminded me of. You also had Sid and Marty Krofft around that time.
That was on ABC.
The banana splits, which were like that. The banana splits were my like go to because I thought they were so cool because they were at Six Flags Over Texas for the opening.
Yes.
And every time we would go, I would look for them, and they were never there.
Yeah, it's like you're pretty sure they were.
We've talked about that on this show before, about us going down to Six Flags and doing that.
You're pretty sure they were somewhere near the Super Slide because you saw it on TV.
Right.
I'm like, hey,
and they
where
had to have cars. You know, they were going around the park in those cars.
Oh, that's right. They were driving around those G.I. Joe six-wheel cars.
Right.
Oh, this is sci-fi / superhero related. This was on Saturday morning in 1976. Dinomutt.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Yeah. Dinomutt.
Falcon.
Dinomutt. And Arc 2.
Oh, in fact, that was on one of my television picks was Arc. I remember Arc 2 as a live-action show with these guys driving around like the remains of the Earth. And, getting in adventures, and they had a monkey, and it's like
I never watched Arc 2, so I'm going by whatever you're telling me.
I loved live-action adventure.
And a lot of those they're on YouTube. You can look them up.
Yeah, you can actually watch some of this.
I went in and did a marathon of Far Out Space Nuts. Was the one with Ruth Buzzy and Jim Neighbors?
The Lost Saucer. Where are we going in the Lost Saucer?
Yeah, and then you had Dr. Shrinker. I was watching all those.
He's an evil man with an evil mind.
With Billy Barty as a sidekick.
Yes! God, Billy Barty. He was doing God's work, I'm telling you.
Oh, you know what? We'd be reluctant to, move on before mentioning this particular gem that was on in 1976. It just popped up on the lineup. Starring two of our very good friends, Cole.
Ah.
Land of the Lost.
Oh, yes, with Wesley Urey and Kathy Coleman.
Yes, who we got to meet last year at Infinity Gauntlet. What am I saying? Infinicon. And actually got each of us got a kiss from Kathy
Yes,
Coleman.
Indeed. How cool is that,
I know. Who could say that they were kissed by the girl, in my case, who got a kiss from the girl who I used to practice kissing her picture in Dynamite magazine.
Right. You didn't reveal that much to Kathy Coleman had to leave at that point. Also, between 76 and 79, a personal favorite, Filmation's Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle.
Oh, definitely.
I absolutely loved the daylights out of that show.
That would have been the same era as the Filmation Batman, I would think, then.
Yeah, I believe you're right, with Batmite. Batmite.
Yeah, I think
the Stunning Adventures of Batman and his ward, Robin. That was always the intro by Ted Knight.
Ted Knight did do the voice.
The Ted Knight intro. He was so excited to intro that show.
He did all the Super Friends, which for me, that is the greatest TV theme of all time.
Don't get me started on Super Friends. Good night. That was just because Aquaman got the best coverage ever, and I love me some Aquaman.
Oh, man.
Jason Momoa. No, maybe not.
don't invoke Jason Mimosa. That's all we need right now. But yeah, no, absolutely. The Super Friends was huge and went on and on for a good long age there. That was one of the most fun things in the 70s was watching Super Friends, because some of the adventures were just like they didn't have until Challenge of the Super Friends. They couldn't have any villains. They had stupid villains like King Plasto and Noah Tall.
Yeah, that's right. and then they were going with the minority characters after a few seasons. So you had Apache.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Was it Black Lightning?
Yeah, Black Lightning. No, Black Vulcan. Black Vulcan.
Right.
Yeah, so. In fact, they parodied that on the Harvey Birdman Attorney at Law, where he was complaining about, Aquaman came up with my name. I said, why don't they call him Whitefish?
Oh, here's another gem that you can actually get this from Warner Archive, the Warner Brothers DVD on demand company that you can order through Amazon and a few other places. They have the live action Super Friends special that were
I actually saw that when it aired,
and I want to say it was before Star Wars, but there were two of them and they were pretty awesome because they had Adam West and Burt Ward. But the second
one,
and it's kind of gone into infamy because they finally added an African-American character who was called Ghetto Man.
Yes,
and it's on YouTube. You have to watch it. Is
It sounds like the superhero version of the Star Wars Holiday Special.
it is fairly terrible, but the nostalgia factor is incredible. So yeah.
Oh, that's right, wow. Ghetto Man. I remember that because I actually saw a DVD of that years later, many many years later. But and
they officially released it though later.
That's true. Yes, they did. Yeah.
And
they admitted it.
They roasted. I forgot who they roasted, but
that's right. It was all set up as a superhero roast. I remember seeing that when it aired, because there's a scene where they're all chasing Mordu from Legion of Superheroes villain across this lake on jet skis, which were pretty new technology back then. And I remember my older brother complaining that you could see the wake of the film boat.
that's what he was focused on, not the fact that they were able to bring this obscure DC villain to the screen, but the fact that you can see the wake of the other boat.
Yeah, the fact that part of a chase scene through the park, they run smack through this poor couple's picnic lunch,
which is why I think when you to try to finally bring this around to Star Wars, why it was so groundbreaking, because prior to this, kids' properties were so kiddish. I mean, with the up in Super Friends, it was very, and then you finally had a movie that, you know, was more embraced just as much by teenagers and young adults than anyone else, because it was fun. It wasn't offensive, which I'm still shocked at watching 70s movies, how much they got away with that in that era.
Yeah, and, I mean, I look back and I'm kind of ashamed that that was my period, as it were.
And I'm surprised that they got away with so little of violence and profanity in it. And I guess that's a tribute to Lucas wanting to make it Flash Gordon, you know. So
yeah, he really would rather have made Flash Gordon, I think, was a very happy accident.
Which is one of the reasons why, and without opening a can of worms, with some of the new films, why I prefer Force Awakens over some of the other films, because the others almost got so serious, and for me, it just wasn't the same amount of fun it was anymore, even though I felt like Force Awakens was kind of ruined with Han. It was just too big of a loss to endure to save the movie, but... you know, as much as I liked the other films, I felt like they almost got too serious, and I think they forgot what those original movies did. And and I think it's the reason why the prequels have been so maligned, is that he was trying to keep it accessible. And it's funny, if you go online now and in these Star Wars fan groups, there's a new fandom for the prequels that people
see. We've talked about that in the show, that early on in some of our earliest episodes, we mentioned that it's only a matter of time before the ones that grew up with Phantom Menace being their first exposure to Star Wars, they're going to come to the age where it's going to be fully embraced by that segment of the fandom.
But you know what really has done it, and other fans, older fans that I know are like my age, because they chime in on some of these groups. They said that really what did it were memes, because you can go in and Revenge of the Sith has been memed. Just about every line in that movie has memed to death. There's a meme for everything. Not so much the other two movies, but that third one, everything from the High Ground to, you know.
That's true.
You know.
So yeah, Padme, you know, you're breaking my heart and all that. Yeah, you're right. I never thought of it, but. They have literally snagged everything from Mace Windu's death scene to the Darth Plagueis story. Yeah, you're right. Everything has been turned into a meme from that movie. It's crazy.
And it's created this nostalgia for what were otherwise mediocre movies. So, I always enjoyed them. I mean, I knew they were, they were never going to live up to whatever, but I still enjoyed them. So.
Well, especially with the amount of time. You know, that had passed between films. And since we're kind of coming around to movies, fascinating. I got really curious about what were we going to see in the cinema in 1976? And there were things that I remember ads for. There were things that I think I went, like, I remember going to see Freaky Friday at the Wynwood Theater.
Mm. Yeah.
In Dallas, and I remember Dino De Laurentiis's King Kong, mm-hmm. which prominently featured the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
Because they were extremely new back then. But then things that were kind of surprising to me, because I never really thought about when did these movies come out, like Marathon Man, Taxi Driver, All the President's Men. And then there were movies you guys may have seen, like The Bad News Bears.
That was 76.
That was 1976, the very first.
Wow.
And I know Jaws was still playing in theaters in 76.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a re-release, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as far as sci-fi, 76 was defined, in my mind, by Logan's
Absolutely.
Run.
Absolutely. And we'll always Logan's Run will be defined, in my mind, by Jenny Allgutter nude for the rest of my life.
I knew that was coming.
Yeah, and I forgot about that, and I think my parents didn't realize they didn't think it was coming, and so they were not happy about that.
But I would imagine so. Okay,
you had all these Dallas and Fort Worth landmarks in it that were just up.
Like the Water Garden. I mean, you talk to people today, like, "Oh yeah, I've been there." Like, what are you talking about? It's in Fort Worth. It's that.
Vic, are you saying we saw Logan's Run? In the theater for initial run or on a re-release?
Well, I don't know about the initial run, but I know we did see it in a theater. I just don't remember.
We did, but it had to have been a re-release. Okay, because I've long held the legend of on the Rancor Pit is like my first experience in the movie theater was Star Wars. That's the first movie I remember going to the theater to see. And I'm hoping that doesn't get ruined by your memory of what I really saw.
I honestly don't remember anything before that. Now, I do remember, like, Cole, which is kind of a small universe kind of a thing. I remember going to the Wynwood Theater quite a bit. I don't remember the years, but I also remember going to – I mean, I remember when Empire and Jedi came out. We went opening day because it was the last day of school, I think.
Oh, yeah. I actually saw Raiders of the Lost Ark at the Wynwood Theater as a sneak. Wow. Like about a week before it came out. The little bitty two-screen Wynwood Theater.
How?
I don't know how they did it, but my mom's like, you want to go see this movie? And I'm like, no.
You know,
this is the movie that took over the Star Wars fan club.
For one cover.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't want to go see some movie about some stupid lion tamer. And then it turns out that's what Willie Scott asked him if he is.
Like, I know.
That is so dead on. I'm sorry, Vic, what you were saying about Wynwood.
I don't know if you realize, I actually had an office in Wynwood for a while, and I got to know some of the folks that in the leasing office that handled the properties. The Wynwood Theater was actually a one-screen theater when it was first built.
Wow.
And they split it into two. And
I had no idea. I just, all of my,
so,
that
so
was
the
our
screen
go-to.
Was just twice as big.
Yeah, it was one big theater, which if you think about it, a lot of those older theaters were that big.
Yeah. And
sure.
And it makes sense, given the layout.
Yeah, yeah. And I do remember also, they, one of the guys, the guy that was in the office there with me, he was there well before I was, and he said the leasing officer took him into the Wynwood after it had closed, and it had been closed for years.
Oh, yes.
And this was the early 90s. He said they literally walked in, and they walked into one of the theaters, and he said the roof had leaked, and there was several feet of rainwater at the bottom of the
wow.
That had essentially ruined the – I mean, that was one of the reasons why they tore it down. I mean, it was structurally – it had fallen apart. So that's why
sad.
Man.
They never brought it back.
Because one movie from 1976 I remember going and seeing at the Wynwood Theater was The Gumball Rally.
Which, never heard
what?
Of that.
The Gumball Rally.
Well, I have not either.
If you've ever heard of, okay, it's Burt Reynolds and Dom DeLuise and Everybody Under the Sun, Cannonball Run. Cannonball Run was effectively the American remake or the big budget remake of The Gumball Rally.
Really?
I'm looking it up now, and
the Gumball Rally
very much
was
invokes Cannonball
Run. This illegal road race.
Yeah.
Kind of thing that,
yeah, July 76.
And also, my dad took a friend of mine and I to go see Midway at the Wynwood.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, listen to the people that were in Gumball Rally. Gary Busey.
Oh my gosh.
Raul Julia. And
it wasn't nearly as star-studded because it, like I said, it was the Cannonball Run was very much inspired by the Gumball Rally.
Yeah, those are the only two names I recognize. Wow. Oh, Colleen Camp. Colleen Camp was in it.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Oh man.
But here's one, Eddie. You might be aware of. You probably didn't see it in '76. The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Oh, I love that movie, but I didn't see it until probably 2006.
Yeah, I figured as much when I saw that on, kind of looking through movies that were very popular in '76.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, this was like Freddy and Jason
was,
and stuff like that before there was Freddy and Jason and
it,
stuff
it
like that.
It literally was. Right, it literally was Jason Voorhees before Jason Voorhees, because that was his first look, was the sack over the head look. Yeah, that's crazy.
Like,
oh, my gosh.
Richard Pryor and Gene, I'm drawing a blank on his name here all of a sudden.
Gene Wilder.
Wilder, yeah. The Silver Streak was released in 76.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood in The Enforcer.
Wow.
Oh, nice.
Rocky, The Omen.
Mm-hmm. Rocky was 76.
Outlaw Josie Wales.
God.
I didn't think that was 76.
Favorite of Sterling Archer, Gator.
Oh, my.
Oh, man. We wow.
The sequel to Westworld.
Man, 76 was a big year in movies.
Pink Panther Strikes Again, the sequel to Westworld, Future World.
Which I finally saw that the other day, and oh my goodness, that was shameful.
I have yet to see that one, but I've seen Westworld because we were watching the new HBO series, and I got curious about the original, which was actually written and directed by Michael Crichton,
right?
Creator of Jurassic Park. Oh, that's right. Yeah, but man, that is some kind of slow. Like, we must have been really bored back in the 70s.
Well, and Rocky was the same way. And I'll tell you this, I don't remember seeing Rocky at the Wynwood, and I'm pretty sure I saw it after Star Wars. And here's why. I remember going to see it, and this must have been the 70s, because my mom and dad were very protective and would not let us do anything crazy. But they dropped me off at the Texas Theater on Jefferson to go see Rocky by myself, because I wanted to go see it.
I wasn't as young, but we used to get dropped off, my brothers and I, at the Wynwood all routinely.
Yep. I was going to say, we got dropped off at the Wynwood to go see Gulliver's Travels. But, of course, it was late 70s. It was after Star Wars, like maybe a year or two after.
I'm just trying to figure out which brother you are. Eddie, do you remember? I remember going to the Wynwood, and Cole, you may not remember this, but on Saturday mornings, they would show these really goofy documentaries that I have caught on occasion when they show on TV, and they're on these free movie channels that are on demand, like off of your Roku.
Yeah. So
there was one about the search for Noah's Ark. There was one about
I remember that movie.
Yeah, it was like a whole series of documentaries. They were all conspiracy stuff.
Yeah, In Search of Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
I think I actually went to see In Search of Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. I remember seeing that. I remember, because I've looked for that particular documentary to add to our DVD collection, mm-hmm. since we have like a whole little Figments collection of DVDs.
Was that the same person that did the Lincoln conspiracy, or was that somebody else? I remember.
You know what? I've never seen the Lincoln one. I just remember the Area 51. I remember the Noah's Ark. And then I remember the one about, and I can't remember the couple's name. It was the couple that really made...
Betty and Barney Hill.
Yes.
Not Betty and Barney, but that's Betty and Barney Rubble. But it was Barney and somebody Hill. I remember his name.
No, I think you're right. I think was it Betty, that kind of irony there?
They were Betty and Barney?
No, I'm pretty sure that's who it is. The Hills. Yeah, it was the Hills. Alien abduction.
Because I remember James Earl Jones played him in this creepy television
movie. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. One of the reasons why one of my favorite guilty pleasures is Fire in the Sky.
It is Betty and Barney Hill.
I'll be damned.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who'd have thought?
Saying it out loud, it sounded wrong.
Yeah, I know, but I don't know how many times we've watched little documentaries on their story, and it never made the connection between the Rebels.
You've been Martha'd.
Oh, man. That's wild. Yeah, I remember definitely.
But this would be 75, so a year before, but the Lincoln conspiracy had come out in 1975. And I know this because my mom and an older brother wanted to go see that, and I wanted so badly to see Ernest Borgnine in The Devil's Reign.
I've never seen that movie. I've never heard of that movie.
Oh, good. I've not seen it since 1975, apparently. But, oh, dear Lord, I wanted to go see The Devil's Reign. And this was at a time when, you know, Dad wouldn't let me go see the double feature of The Boy Who Cried Werewolf and
Oh,
I do remember that.
So my dad begrudgingly took me to see The Devil's Reign.
Yeah.
And Ernest Borgnine pulls a taut in Area. Yeah. He does a wicked witch in it.
Just real quick, going back to the Lincoln conspiracy, I wanted to make sure I looked this up to make sure I wasn't giving false information, because I was 98% sure about this, that the producer, the writer and producer of the Lincoln conspiracy was Chuck Sellier, which is the man behind many of those documentaries from the 70s, The Encounters with the Unknown, like Easter Island, Hangar 18.
Hangar 18, like, I went and saw that.
Yes, he was doing Figments before there was a Figments. He is the man behind my all-time, this is like the Star Wars of Bigfoot documentaries to me, Mysterious Monsters.
Oh, wow.
It was like he did... my favorite, Ichabod Crane, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, with Jeff Goldblum as Ichabod Crane. I mean, this man's, if you go to IMDb, he's the one who did In Search Of. He did In Search Of Noah's Ark. He did In Search Of Historic Jesus. Remember In Search Of Historic Jesus, where they talked about the Shroud of Turin? He was the man who brought the whole Shroud of Turin thing to, like, the public eye. Mm. This man's career is, like, unparalleled as far as the conspiracy theories he brought into the public eye in the 70s and 80s.
Which was primed for those kind of movies. the whole
right.
distrust of government and all that, and, you know, you can't, yeah.
Yeah, his company was Sun Classics, and I guarantee you both, if you were to see the logo pop up, you would immediately remember it, because the moment we finally got our hands on a copy of Mysterious Monsters on DVD, and we popped it in, and that Sun Classics logo popped up, Colleen and I just looked at each other like, oh my gosh, we forgot about this logo, because his logo would pop up on everything. All these movies that you would see on TV and in theaters was the Sun Classics logo. Yeah. I mean, it was almost as eye opening as the last time Vic was on the show and brought up Handy Dan, because I hadn't thought about Handy Dan since 1977.
Well, you guys were Oak Cliff boys. You probably remember Naylor's restaurant over on.
No.
Oh dear Lord, that was my dad's favorite place to eat. It was over on Hampton in Illinois.
Okay.
Was that
the one on the very corner right there?
Yeah, there's like a gas station there now.
Oh, okay.
Because that entire section there. Of that strip center was taken out and given over to a gas station.
Oh, okay. Because I remember there being a bank there on the very corner.
Yes. In fact, next to the bank was Austin's Barbecue.
Yes.
Tender as old Austin's heart.
Oh my God.
Uh huh.
And that corner across the street was a Dallas Public Library branch.
Yes,
the
dreaded Mott's that Vic and I hated going into because they had all the figures we wanted, but at a price we couldn't afford.
Exactly, and they kept them, like, by Empire, they were putting their Star Wars figures about 14 feet off the ground.
Right.
Yes!
They were so paranoid.
But next door...
Vic, remember how...
No, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say next door was a far better place, which was for a while the Sears Outlet store.
Oh, that's right.
I remember picking up a few. I think we picked up a few Magos later on, like in the 80s. I know for sure that one year for my birthday, I remember what I wanted, and they couldn't find it. And I wanted a Mork from Ork doll. It was a 12-inch doll with a talking backpack.
Yeah.
And it was hanging upside down in the box. That's what I wanted. And this must have been 80, 81. And they couldn't find it anywhere. And I said, it's at Sears. And I literally begged them. They were like, you can't do that. And I convinced them to let me go get it myself. And they were like, we can get it. And they were like, no, I want to get it. as if there were going to be others that they couldn't find. So I went in and grabbed my Mork from Ork doll, which is
great.
And it was packaged upside down, like he would do in the show.
Yes, they were very clever in the marketing of that toy.
I barely remember that
I
doll.
Can tell you
what I do remember
is dead. I mean, it would say Nanu Nanu, of course, Shazbot.
This is a family show.
Well, he would say, "Never go to Pluto. It's a Mickey Mouse planet."
I remember that line. Yes,
he would
that
say,
was from one of his. Diatribes. I remember he was talking about all the different planets. You know, I don't go to Pluto.
And
to make
there
it
were a few more. Yeah, I think he said like five or six of these, and there was this huge backpack that you would strap onto his back, and a pretty decent likeness. It looked just like him.
Yeah, really did. I remember when that came out. So real quick, I wanted to kind of give a full picture of 76.
This is about Star Wars, isn't it? We haven't even talked about Star Wars.
We're talking about the land before Star Wars, but to kind of give you an idea, Vic, you had mentioned Saturday Night Fever, which came out in 77, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the groundwork was being laid for Travolta to become a superstar. Disco was definitely alive and well. one of the top songs of 1976 was the parody by a radio DJ. You know where I'm headed. Disco, Disco Duck.
Exactly.
Wow, very nice. But I was kind of looking over a list.
A ridiculously stupid song.
I know.
How?
But everything was either disco or CB radios.
Yeah.
And I think CB was like maybe 77, 78, mm-hmm. where you started getting uh-huh. CB culture was huge. But a few of the top songs of 76, Island Girl from Elton John. Oh, my gosh. Shop Around by Captain and Tennille.
Barbra Streisand has got to be on that list, right?
Oh, bound to. I'm kind of scrolling here back and forth. Dream On by Aerosmith. If You Leave Me Now from Chicago. Show wow. Me the Way.
Oh, wow. That's from 76?
Yes. Or at least they were. I don't know if they were necessarily released in 76, but they were
in the charted, top 100. They charted.
The theme yeah. from SWAT was a popular song in 1976 because that was a popular show in 1976.
I don't remember it being all that memorable.
I guess
I
guess that's not any different than the CSI theme got really popular again. The
yeah,
Who Are You? That hit big on
Ron
on
Burgundy's favorite
again. Yeah.
Afternoon Delight.
Oh, of Ooh. Course. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't realize that was that year, too. Wow.
Yeah, Don't Go Breaking My Heart with Elton John and Kiki.
Oh.
Whatever happened to Kiki D? I don't know. Silly Love Songs, Paul McCartney and Wings.
Wait, Don't Go Breaking My Heart?
Yeah. yeah.
That don't was go Elton breaking John?
My heart. I couldn't have thought all these. You didn't know who that was?
Oh, that's Elton John? No, for some reason, I thought that was like Captain and Tennille. So, I don't know. I don't know music.
It, I can see where you would think.
Yeah.
That. The Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. I didn't realize wasn't as old as I thought it was.
Right.
Boogie oh. Fever.
God, that was. But all the disco songs were terrible. I mean, there were a few that hold up. A few of the Donna Summer songs were good. I'm sorry.
Chicago holds up.
Yeah. Well, but were they really? They were almost easy listening into disco, and The Bee Gees still worked for me.
Oh, of course.
Oh, yeah. You and I gotta love the Brothers Gibb.
Yeah. They've all gone to the great disco floor beyond.
Ah, yes, I know.
we'll pour one out for them. Mm.
We're out of Fanta for the Peach.
Fanta. Good. I just looking over some of these, I'm like, I don't even know if I remember any of these. And Junk Food Junkie by Larry Grossi. Who knew?
Mm. I've never heard of that.
Oh, my God.
I haven't either. Who's Squeeze Box was popular in 76.
Never heard of that.
Mama's got a squeeze box she wears on her chest. Anyway, I'm probably
I'm not sure about that. I think it was meant
to be like a little accordion.
Oh, dirty, okay. When you say freak. Squeeze box. Well, no. At first when you said squeeze box, I was thinking like a Juicy Juice box or something. Okay. Like those weren't even around back then. Not even Capri Sun was around back then. So maybe you had like, you know, Tang, but that came in a big bottle.
And of course, With Your Love, and the reason I bring this one up is because it was by none other than Jefferson Starship, who a couple of years later would appear on the Star Wars Holiday Special.
That's right. Totally forgot about that.
So let's wrap up with talking about where, you know, this is the world without Star Wars.
So, real quick, one thing I wanted to... This is one thing I'm just going to touch on real quick. Something else that made its debut in 1976, courtesy of McDonald's, the Filet-O-Fish sandwich.
Wow! I didn't think about that. What were we eating in 76? Oh.
With mascot Phil A. O'Fish. Phil
A.
Initial A.
So Phil O'Fish has a middle initial. The last name. I'm just sowing the weeds with Filet-O-Fish.
And he's Irish?
Filet-O-Fish. I didn't even know the Filet-O-Fish sandwich had a mascot at some point, but apparently in 1976 it did. Oh my gosh! Wait, hold on, give me one second.
Was Filet-O-Fish the puppet sandwich? Because like later on they would have that pirate guy fishing for these actual sandwiches that had like dorsal fins and pectoral fins and big fish tails, and they were like jumping around in the water and he was trying to fish for them. So to me, would indicate that the buns would get really soggy.
I can't confirm this 100%, but I think in 1976 we also saw the introduction of the Sloppy Joe seasoning mix.
Wow, was Matwich
in? I don't know if that's I don't know if that's when it actually came out, but this one thing claims that Lowry's came out with a thing called Sloppy Joe seasoning mix
in
the little package.
I actually found, we're going to use this in the flavor art for the show, I found a picture of Phil.
Yeah, he's quite a dapper little guy.
Yeah, he's like he's like an admiral or something. And
but in the 2000s,
he's got like a nautical, like a pea coat with epaulets and filigree. And then he's just wearing like a straw hat, like he's gonna go, like when he stops, cruising along on a warship, he goes and moonlights in Venice.
Right, as a paddler, and oddly enough, he has a fishing net.
Yeah.
So apparently he's backstabbing his own kind.
Oh yeah, he's willing to kill his own
for the almighty dollar.
You mean he didn't put it out to who was it, the Gordon's fisherman to do all the work?
Yeah, really.
I know. he looks like a much
Gordon's
classier
fisherman
version.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Anyway, bad recall joke to a very obscure commercial.
Oh, sorry. Okay, the Sloppy Joe did not debut in 1976. It actually debuted in 1930.
Oh, wow.
By a cook in Sioux City, Iowa, whose name was Joe. He added tomato sauce to his loose meat for sandwiches.
Yeah, that may have been the take-home kit. The Lowry's may have come out that year.
That's probably what came out in 76 was the little take-home thing. Manwich came out with their canned stuff in 76, I guess, to combat Lowry's seasoning packet. So Lowry's probably came out with the little seasoning packet, and Manwich said, we can do you
there
one
you
better.
There you go. We're going to beat you to the punch here. And I found an ad for your Filet-O-Fish where octopi are suckers for them.
this is so turned into something I did not expect it to turn into.
And that's really what we want. My goal here was to literally paint a picture of,
oh my god,
yeah, where were we in those times?
It was a dark ugly time is what it was, with
the dark times
and no fashion sense to speak of.
I don't think we
the
realized
dark times before the empire.
I don't think we realized how much Lucas saved us from ourselves until this moment.
Right. You should get a Nobel Peace Prize.
Exactly. So let's look at, we need to probably wrap this sucker up anyway, but we'll take a quick look at where was Star Wars itself in 1976. And I was surprised to find, I thought they would have been like much further along.
I know, it's crazy.
What was it? That's not it. It was like March of 76, I believe.
Yeah, I believe it was March 22nd. Yeah, March. I think we put that meme on our site. It was like,
oh, no, is that it?
It's March 22nd.
Yeah, okay, you're right. So, March of 76, they're all, like, setting up shop in the deserts of Tunisia and shooting the Tatooine stuff on the first days of principal photography. March 22nd.
Just 14 months prior. But to back it up to January 1st of that year, January 1st, 76, Lucas completes the fourth draft of, quote, The Adventures of Luke Starkiller as taken from the Journal of the Wills, Saga 1. Well, hold on,
Yes.
Journal of the Wills, Saga 1, The Star Wars. That was the working title. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 words. A working title, 18 words long.
Insane.
You're never going to fit that on a marquee.
And then they just went
down. Why don't we just call this movie The Wills? Let's just call this movie The Wills.
That's right.
No. Let's call it The Star Wars. That's better. Okay, we'll go with that.
That's amazing.
But yeah,
and I really have a feeling that was a marketing guy. Some marketing guy said, "Come on, y'all, it's just called Star Wars." That had to be because I've never heard Lucas tell a story about how he finally decided to whittle it down. So
actually, yeah. I often recommend this on the show. Is it J.W. Rinsler?
Yeah,
J.W. Right. Rinsler's The Making of Star Wars. You read that book, and you wind up asking yourself, "How did this movie actually get made?" And a lot of it is Alan Ladd Jr., who, you know, his suspension of disbelief was amazing. I mean, the ideas that were in the Journal of the Wills period, some of the concepts were just awful. And you see that George Lucas is brilliant and not so brilliant simultaneously.
He needs someone to work with him, which is why he worked so well with Spielberg, when Spielberg and the two of them were, you know, really going at each other. And it's one of the reasons why Star Wars was so great was because, Gary Kurtz was one of the few guys that kind of tempered and kind of helped focus.
And I forgot their name.
He's not the yes man that Rick McCallum was.
Yeah, I think the prequels, personally, I think the reason they suffer so much with a lot of the first generation Star Wars fans is that Lucas had so many hands. There were so many people. George Lucas's name is on Star Wars. But there was a couple that he knew very well who were screenwriters. There are so many people that had a pass at that screenplay and whittled things out, and so many ideas that had to wait because they were just not unworkable. And in many ways, there was just a lot of jumping around from place to place, and it was patently unnecessary. Mm-hmm. But if you can get your hands on a copy of The Making of Star Wars, it's a massive tome. But it is, it's you know, you need to like sit at your kitchen table to read it because it's, or have a lectern or something, because it's not easy to just, you know, like lie in bed and read unless there's an electronic version. But it's not only chock full of information, there's all kinds of archival stuff like, you know, handwritten notes and early, and it will actually tell you, here's where the script was at this point. Mm-hmm. Fast forward 2 months, here's where the script was at this point.
This is bizarre. Almost 2 months to the day, January 20th, before they started principal photography, at 2 months before, they were just barely coming up with the blueprint for RTD2.
Yes!
That blows my mind, that in 2 months, they were able to come up with RTD2, a working RTD2. That's crazy.
And I think one of the things I want to point out about, because they're principal photography begins in Tunisia with Tatooine scenes, that I remember reading in Rinsler's book about how the production loaded up all of these trucks of all the props and costumes and the equipment and everything, and were ferried across the channel to France to begin, I forget how many days of driving to Africa. And I got to think about, wait a minute, I guess they're all pretty much connected once you get over on the mainland.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, the thought of driving from France to Africa.
Uh-huh. It's crazy, but yeah.
I mean, I know the Germans did it during the war, but...
Oh.
No, it's a,
those
it's
crazy
okay
Germans.
To say that because I have my puppets.
Yeah.
What was the song? What was the song, Vic?
I've been working on the railroad.
Oh, that's right.
I've been working on the railroad.
Oh my gosh. We should mention very quickly how the first day of principal photography was nearly derailed by Jesus of Nazareth. And before anybody gets offended, literally the day before when they showed up to the hotel that they were making plans to all stay at, the cast and crew, they showed up and it was closed for renovations. And so the other hotel was booked up solid by the cast and crew of the television miniseries Jesus of Nazareth that was also filming there. So they ended all up splitting up and all splitting up to different fourth-rate hotels, they said, and they were doubling, tripling, and quadrupling up in rooms together. For they said 2 to 3 weeks, they had to double, triple, and quadruple up in rooms at these bootleg hotels.
Well, that explains why there's mention of, like, Anthony Daniels having not gotten much sleep during their time in Cuba.
Yeah, that's exactly it. They were saying the first day of shooting, he was really cranky. Not, I mean, like, they say he was professional and enduring.
Well, he's English, for God's sake. I mean, you know, the difference between the happiest and most cranky Englishman is there's not a wide range of emotion in between.
But they said it's because he didn't get much sleep, and his suit was – they were still tweaking his suit, so it was like cutting into him as he moved around.
Oh, that's right,
They hadn't quite worked out all the bugs of the suit. So,
and then, of course, as is inevitable when you are trying to get something done with a lower budget, highly ambitious film like this, the weather turns nasty.
Oh, gosh, yeah. The big sandstorm?
Yeah.
Wasn't there a big sandstorm somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, and it plagued them for almost the entire shoot in Tunisia. So, again, there's so many places where it's amazing, but it's just kind of neat to know that in 76, when we were going to see Gator in the movie theaters, or the Duchess and the Dirtwater Fox, or Across the Great Divide, or, you know, maybe if you're so inclined, you went to go see Bill Cosby and Mother Jugs and Speed with Raquel Welch.
We can no longer invoke Bill Cosby on this podcast.
But, you know, these were the things that were going on in the theaters. And we were watching, you know, Welcome Back, Kotter, and Good Times. And, you know, all that summer, we had no idea what was going on, those of us who became major Star Wars fans.
We're about, if I can interrupt real quick, Cole, we're about 12 minutes before we got to cut this off. There's three things I want to touch on Star Wars related in 76, if we can kind of like talk about this. Number one, San Diego Comic-Con, summer of 76.
Oh my, that's a good thing. Yes.
That's the first time the public is made aware of Star Wars, because they have, and you look at the pictures and I've had a better display table as an artist in Artist Alley than they did for Star Wars. It was literally just a tablecloth with the original Macquarie logo.
Yes, the triangular one.
Right, and they were I couldn't confirm this. People have said that they were giving out posters at one point, and I did find a copy of this. It gave out a flyer printed on bright yellow paper with the old Macquarie, Luke Skywalker, the old Star Wars logo, and it details out, almost spoilerish, the whole concept of the movie Star Wars. These flyers are actually given out to people, and someone actually has one that they scanned in and uploaded.
Oh,
it's,
wow.
We don't have the time for me to read through it, but it's, if you just look up anything related to...
I think I have seen that, yes.
Yeah, could you imagine having held on to one of those and then discover it after the fact that, oh my gosh? And Mark Hamill was apparently there, kind of talking to people, trying to tell people.
Oh yeah, he's got this like movie. This crappy little section with a big banner with the Star Wars, what was the initial Star Wars logo, and I believe that the poster they had was the Howard Chaykin.
Mm-hmm. Poster. Yes, that's right, because Chaykin and Archie Goodwin, I believe. Let me look at this real quick. Yeah, no, Roy Thomas, the writer who wrote the initial run of Star Wars and gave us Jackson the Green Rabbit, Roy Thomas and Howard Chaykin were there to promote the comic book and Star Wars the movie, and the first panel, they said the first panel, the first official Star Wars panel was there, and they said, apparently it was reported that people were just like so bored just sitting there listening to this, that some people actually fell asleep during the Star Wars panel, if you can imagine that. But yeah, they, speaking of the comic, this is one of the other things I wanted to bring up. 76 also gave us, the deal was made between Marvel Comics and Lucasfilm to produce the Star Wars comic book series. So they went into, they struck the deal in 76, and I would imagine went into production in 76. This is the odd thing I did not realize until researching this, this for this podcast. In December of 76, we get the paperback novel Star Wars from the Adventures of Luke Skywalker. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
6 months ahead of time, in a world where now we're paranoid about things getting spoiled, mm-hmm. 6 months before Star Wars came out, you could have read the whole story in December. Imagine that. Imagine if now we would have gotten, like, the Force Awakens novel 6 months before Force Awakens came out, and then everyone would have... You would have seen memes of the story, you know, like the next day, practically. But the cover to this novel is awesome because it's all Macquarie. It's all Macquarie early production stuff.
Yes,
you know, it's where the C-3PO that looks like the Metropolis robot. It's Vader where his helmet looks more like a samurai helmet. Luke is wearing like his Bespin looking fatigues. It's Chewbacca looks more like a dog, upright dog, than he does a Wookiee. It's amazing. It's amazing what they have.
No, that's a good point about the Comic-Con that year, and a extremely young Mark Hamill there in his Star Wars shirt. And the guys from Lucasfilm that were doing the panels with the same logo shirt in yellow, in the sort of chiffon yellow. It's just like that was fashionable. Back then.
And their bell bottoms and everything.
Yes.
There was one photo. It was so funny because the focus was the Star Wars table, and I believe it was Roy Thomas. No. I forget the guy's name, but he was somewhere involved in the Lucasfilm production crew. He was the guy sitting at the table greeting people and telling them about Star Wars and handing out the stuff. He's almost overshadowed by, in the background, I guess it's a guy who was selling, like, bootleg reels of, or he was selling reels of movies, like Super 8.
Yes, I actually stumbled on the very picture.
Right, and then above that, right next to that is this big sign, like, either not smoking, no smoking. If you're looking at the photo, Cole, maybe.
Yes, it is. It looks like it says no smoking. It looks like something you would get the kids at the high school to make for you on poster board.
With markers. And it's almost like taken away from their Star Wars table because it's so, like, big and, like, eye-catching, like,
And if you want to see how ubiquitous the geek look is, this picture from 1976, which we'll have to use for the flavor art, this one guy approaching the table has been cloned and resurfaces every decade, looking and dressed exactly the same. You see that guy off to the right there? He's just...
Oh, man.
That's funny.
He's been around forever, so...
Oh my gosh. I think he actually showed up at the Logos Youth Center when all of us were putting on our little events.
I think he probably did. Same guy. He just is ageless.
Same guy. Dressed the same. One more thing that that came out in 76, December of 76, was the teaser trailer.
Ah, yes. Now, this is the one, I believe, where it was like the most non-Star Wars approach to selling Star Wars. Is this the a boy, a girl, heroes and villains?
I think that was a TV spot.
Okay, yeah, I remember seeing the TV spot, like, obviously, like it was yesterday. And creatures unlike anything on your world.
Or it could have been a later trailer, I don't know, but this particular one was actually not too bad. This is the one where they're showing clips from the film, and they keep coming back to the logo. The logo starts far away, and it's slowly getting closer and closer to the screen, and it's a different font than what they ended up with.
It's got what I would call a Macquarie font, because for some reason it just puts me in the mind. It just works with Macquarie's style. Similar font was used for Phil A.O. Fish.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. and instead of John Williams' music, because John Williams, you know, the music hadn't been publicly released yet, obviously. They were using the music in the trailer was a version of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, the winter part of his Four Seasons musical piece. So that's the music that you're hearing, and it's not half bad. And they from the man who brought you American Graffiti, and everybody's like, wait, what? What's American Graffiti? What's that?
Wow.
But no, it they showed quite a bit. And again, in a world where we go frame by frame when these trailers come out and people are trying to figure out the movie and is this going to happen and is that going to happen, this, when you watch this trailer, it spoils everything. They show Leia getting rescued, so she knows you get rescued. They show the Death Star blowing up. They show the Death Star blowing
That's
up
right.
in the teaser
yes.
trailer. It's crazy.
Like somebody tell them.
So they spoiled the whole movie. I'm surprised they didn't show Obi-Wan get killed.
Exactly.
But no, that's...
I'm glad you brought all those up, because those are important aspects of, you know, precisely what, you know, what was it like before and leading up to Star Wars?
Yeah. Okay, final 2 minutes before we got to get out of here. Any last words for our last 2 minutes?
Vic, you got anything you want to share on the 1976? And I guess I before that I should point out, 1976 historically was the bicentennial of the United States of America.
Yeah, well,
there.
Very good.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't have. I think I've said. I think I'm talked out.
So, well, I thank you for joining us. I want to say you bring. To have both of you having grown up from a very young age, first encountering Star Wars, and, you know, much younger than I was at the time, and having carried that through. And since you're here, Vic, I hate you both again for that whole damn thing at Redbird Mall.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Because you kids could win prizes.
And because I could drive
myself there.
And we had to ride our Huffies.
Do you have a Huffy Thunder Road?
I don't
remember. What, shoot.
But another flashback for you. But, you know, amazing things that helped illustrate exactly. This has been everything I was looking for in this episode. You know, when we realized last time we'd already hit 75. And I thought, let's do something about 76 for number 76. And no, we're not going to talk about 1977 next week. In a couple of weeks, rather. So, Vic, again, thank you for joining us. Thank you for that trip down memory lane and for all of us remembering iconic landmarks of Old Oak Cliff, like West Cliff Mall and other things.
In Wynwoo. Yeah. And Vic, what website do you want everyone to check out?
Oh, two websites, revengeofthefifth.net and theweekendnerd.com. Now, I can tell you this is the first time I've actually mentioned this. We have actually finally, after I don't even remember how many years it's been now. No, we started in 2012, I believe. We have acquired revengeofthefifth.com. So we will have the official revengeofthefifth.com website web address. It's not up yet, so don't type it in. It goes to some whatever, but it goes nowhere, I think. But yeah, no, at some point we will be integrating that into the website.
Wonderful,
awesome.
And of course, you can find us Jedi Cole Universe at jedicole.com for this. the pre-recorded show, and in the first and third Sundays of every month over at DallasOnAir.com for the Rancor Pit Live, which has celebrated 100 episodes.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yep, yep. It's hard to believe. We actually surpassed our original version of the show, which was the audio podcast.
Yeah, the sad irony is we're 25 behind on this show, but we're working on it, even though right, this is older.
We'll get caught up. Yeah, 6 months older. Go figure. That's what happens when we put ourselves in charge and Jansen's not
exactly.
looking over our shoulder.
We don't have somebody insisting.
When you have Jansen looking over your shoulder, yeah, exactly.
If somebody's insisting you show up every couple of weeks, then you show up every couple of weeks. Well, yeah, Eddie, right. Thank you, Vic, thank you, and everybody out there, if you weren't around in 76, we hope we gave you some insights into what was going on in the days of rotary phones and analog wristwatches and penny candy. And
penny candy. It's not Olson's Mercantile. Good night.
And with that, good night, everybody.
This awesome music is provided by Ray Reezy. That's R-E-Y-R-Z-Y. You can find him on Instagram and SoundCloud. On Instagram, it's at R-E-Y-R-Z-Y. And on SoundCloud, it's soundcloud.com/R-E-Y-R-Z-Y. You can also contact him at rayreezymusic@gmail.com. Make sure you check out this guy's stuff. It's really awesome. Thanks for listening, and may the force be with you.